Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee.
And you're listening to the Grok Science Show.
That's right, it's a weekly look at the world of science, technology, and their effects on our daily lives.
Coming up on this week's show, Angelica Ung joins us to talk about the latest in science news.
So stay tuned for all of this.
Plus the Grokatron 5000.
And our world famous question of the week.
Coming right up.
Here.
On the Grok's
Science Show. Welcome back to the program. I'm Frank Ling.
And I guess that makes me Charles Leaf.
And I'm Angelica calling in from Taipei, Taiwan.
Yeah, welcome. How is everything going in Taiwan?
Well, you can say we were a little bit shaken up last week with the earthquake. That was the biggest one we've had in 25 years. But luckily, I think considering the magnitude of the earthquake, we're doing quite all right. The quake mostly struck the city of Hualien on the eastern side of the island. A lot of roads are out. Some tourists who were there, unfortunately, were crushed. But no big buildings came down. The death toll is maybe 18 or so. So for an earthquake of this magnitude, even though it's still unfortunate, you have to remember the last time we had a quake like this in 1999, thousands of people died and they were digging survivors out of the rubble for weeks. So compared to that, Taiwan is doing very well.
It's good to hear. Did you feel it at all when it shook?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. When it started shaking, I knew within a couple of seconds that this was the biggest earthquake I've ever experienced in my life, because I happened to be away from Taiwan for the last big one 25 years ago. But in Taipei, even though it was a big quake with a series of earthquakes, it wasn't as extreme as it was down in Hualien on the East Coast.
Oh, wow. I think both Frank and I were in Pasadena when the Northridge quake hit. Were you there?
Uh-huh. Yes, I was. That's my freshman year. And actually, that was my very first exposure to journalism. So one of my dorm mates, we dressed up and we pretended we were journalists, and we kind of hung out with the press pool. And then apparently we were caught on camera.
And that pretending has continued to this day.
Never stopped. Yeah. A secret. When you pretend to be a journalist and then you start doing journalism, that's when you actually become a journalist.
We are who we pretend to be, as the Vonnegut.
We still haven't gotten back to the Oscars.
Well, there you have to act as a journalist. We did talk our way into a fashion show once as journalists. Do you remember that, Frank?
Yeah, is that the NAMM conference in Las Vegas?
That one too. Yeah, no, we've talked our way into a lot of different things as journalists.
Good times.
Anyway, I'm glad to hear that everything is good and safe in Taiwan. Of course, our thoughts go out to everybody there. So it didn't turn out worse.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles.
Great. So what's going on?
Yes, there's a lot going on in this whole area of cloud engineering. I'm not talking about data centers here. So literally,
not data centers, clouds. Actual cloud. In the sky, white and fluffy.
That's right. So there's been this idea that to stave off global climate change, we should change the albedo of our atmosphere. And that means seeding it with certain types of aerosols that could reflect solar light or to produce more clouds. And so I think we've known in previous like volcanic eruptions, it led to a slight cooling of the planet because of the reflection from those particles. And what scientists have found are that these aerosols can cool the ground by up to 10 watts per square meter.
Watts per square meter.
Mm-hmm. So in contrast, like if you look at the effect of CO2 concentrations, pre-industrially, you know, the CO2 concentration was 280, right? And it's predicted that if we reach 560 or doubling of that, then that adds 3.7 watts per square meter. But this more than offsets that. And right now we're in like 420 parts per million. So we're probably only a few years away from actually hitting the doubling. So if there needs to be some sort of a drastic cooling, then cloud seeding of some sort to engineer these types of albedo effects could be one way to delay climate change, like the effects of it worsening.
I think it absolutely should be investigated. And there's so much resistance to that. There's almost people in the mainstream who are afraid that we investigate these geoengineering type interventions, that somehow it'll take the foot off the gas for the more mainstream effects of reducing carbon dioxide.
Right.
But to me, we're so close to the edge. I'm not sure the mainstream effects are going to come through in time. So something to kind of buffer our temperature rise is needed. And so I'm very glad to hear that people are doing that sort of research.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I think, nuance that has to be ironed out before anyone does this on a large scale. But it's certainly a valid hypothesis to try this, right? And, you know, this is work that's being done at the University of Birmingham in the UK. It's funded by their Advanced Research and Invention Agency. So something that I think a lot of researchers and policymakers are interested in is see if there are certain, what they call it, painkillers to alleviate the effects of global warming. It was certainly not a solution, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I like that they call it painkillers.
I would say leave it to the UK to be interested in clouds.
Yeah, I've only been there like a few days in total. And every single day has been pretty cloudy and cool.
You would think they'd be trying to go the opposite way. It's like the, you know, getting rid of the clouds. So what's the plan? Is it conduct small-scale seeding experiments, build this up to sort of large scale?
Right now, this is more of a model that they've developed using satellite data, meteorological data, and a bit of AI learning. So would you be able to test it out on a regional scale that hopefully would not have harmful effects, right? So this is the worry with a lot of these geoengineering projects, is there are unintended consequences, which could be much more harmful.
A clouding thing that sends us into a snowball Earth or something.
That would be an ironic way to go for the human race.
If people want to learn more about this story, where can they go?
Yeah, so certainly there's been some press about this. It originally came out of Nature Geoscience at the beginning of April, and there's a really nice press release in Eureka Alert.
And Angelica, I hear that you've got some science that has helped you in terms of your fitness.
Absolutely, Charles. Let me tell you, before I get into the science, let's talk a little bit about my personal story with fitness, which is that I've always hated cardio. I hated it. I knew it was important. I would make myself do it. And this is ever since, as soon as I started exercising, which was in college, so back when I was 19. So can you imagine hating this thing for decades? And I'm talking about every time I get on a treadmill, I feel like I'm going to die. But I feel like I have to do it, right? You have to do it. So when I do go to the gym, I will do my cardio once a week and it'll be like 20, 30 minutes. I feel like I'm going to die. I'm going to start and rinse and repeat. And it was just a revelation when I discovered the work of Dr. Inigo Sen-Milan just a few weeks ago. I have to say, though, I also want to give some credit to my personal trainer because he was the one that suggested Angelica. You need to do more cardio, but do it at a lower pace. Don't let yourself be in pain. I was like, well, how does that work? I thought that was how cardio was supposed to work. But I did some research, and it turns out that there is a training method that is really promulgated by many things in science. He built on the work of others, but he really popularized it. He is the trainer for the Team UAE in professional cycling. And so we're talking about those guys, you know, professional cyclers, they push themselves to the extreme when it comes to cardio. They are the cardio stars. But he keeps most of his athletes, most of the time, in what he calls zone two cardio. The idea is you break your heart rate into zones. Zone one is almost like you're not working at all. Zone two is when the test for zone two, if you don't want to get into the heart rate monitors, et cetera, it's like you are kind of a little bit out of breath, but you can still hold a conversation. You can still talk with a friend. Then you're in zone two. Zone three is when your breath becomes too broken up to do that. And then zone four and zone five and even zone six are just more and more extreme. And he's saying you should be doing most of your training in zone two. And so I did some zone two training, and I was blown away that I was able to do an hour of cardio. I completely did not feel fatigued at all. And the next day, I was completely functional. I had no soreness. And I was like, well, wait. So there was no pain. Certainly, there was no pain. But am I getting the gains? Where are the gains? And it turns out, after I heard, the gains are actually right in yourself. They are within yourselves, in the powerhouse of the cell, the mitochondria. So it turns out that your body has different systems for producing energy. And when you're in zone two, you're completely using the fat pathway. So you're maximizing the amount of fat burned. I think there might be some sugars as well, but mostly it's the fat. You're on the upper limit of maximizing fat burning. You're training yourselves to burn more and more fat. And that not only increases the number of your mitochondria, it's making them more effective. So that's the kind of effect that it's not about how much calories I'm burning while I'm on the treadmill. It's about making yourself a more effective fat burning machine. And when I read that, when I heard that, I was completely blown away. And I applied it immediately to my training. Now I do at least 3 to 4 hours of zone two cardio a week. And my overall fitness level, energy level, it is just, it's only been a couple of weeks, but I've been feeling amazing. And this is in fact what athletes do. Of course, they balance it with several very intense sessions where they really push themselves to the edge. And that might also be described as polarized training, when you spend most of your time very easy and then a small percentage of your time really pushing the edges of an endurance. And that's supposed to be the way to get maximum performance. So I really, after struggling with cardio all my life, cardio is finally my friend, and I have science to thank for it.
Of course, that there's two modes. One is sort of the aerobic mechanism where you're actually using more oxygen. But if you go too fast, then you've gone into anaerobic, building up, produces lactic acid, which is the stuff that winds up causing the burn over time. And that's winds up being a little bit more deleterious over time. Shift between aerobic and anaerobic also helps because it doesn't get the mitochondria into stable state. So it winds up going into the aerobic burning of fats or sugars, depending on which source of energy you're using.
Yeah. I think that's actually the biggest challenge for me now while I'm doing my cardio, is to make sure that my heart rate doesn't spike into that anaerobic zone. Because it takes your body forever to kind of gently settle down again. And what you want is your heart rate to be flat as a pancake. It can dip down, that doesn't hurt it, but don't let it spike up and maintain it for the entirety of the cardio session.
Yeah, and the other thing is that a lot of the calories that you burn are actually at rest. So
yeah,
the training is actually to produce cells that will burn more calories at rest.
Exactly.
So-called brown fat tissue, which is stuff that keeps you warm, thermogenesis, all this kind of stuff that helps to keep that basal level of metabolism going at a higher rate.
Yeah. And I personally, this might be old news for a lot of people. I didn't know that there are things that you can do to even affect the mitochondrial health. I thought that when you train, your muscle cells got bigger, or when you're training, doing weight training, that enables them to grow as they heal. But I had no idea that these tiny, tiny mitochondria are so responsive to training. And also, it's gotten me interested, and I'm reading up on other ways to take care of the mitochondria and support them. So
love your mitochondria, and they'll love you back.
That's right.
It doesn't look like there's a really strict diet to go with this, or is there something you need to...
This is the best part. Frank, this is the best part. Dr. Samelan, he's from the Basque country, okay? You can't take carbs away from those people. They love to eat. And he also loves chocolate. He doesn't think that life is worth living without chocolate. And he notes very correctly that if you look at the world's existing hunter-gatherer peoples, they don't have metabolic disease. They're very, very healthy. They live about as long as we do, and they probably would live longer with very basic interventions to make sure they're not, you know, dying from infectious disease, etc. So look at their diet. You think the paleo diet is all about meat and protein, but those people closest that we've got to existing paleo people, they're actually eating a mostly a plant-based diet. you know, they hunt, they're hunter-gatherers, but they don't get that much meat. Their metabolic health is excellent because they move so much. They could move in a single day. What the American Health Association tells you, you should exercise for a whole week. So his idea is, if your metabolic health is good, if you have these high quality mitochondria and many of them in your cells, then you're much more protected against the different kinds of nutrition intake. You want to eat more carbs, eat a bit more carbs. You don't need to be doing keto or something like that. So I also find myself much more relaxed about food intake, and so far it's working well. We'll check in a few months and see.
Yeah, no, this is very, very exciting. It's always interesting to know what are the specific factors or activities that really do lead to better health. And maybe there are other cofactors, but even if, yeah, we identify the general ones, that should be quite interesting for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think we're always finding out more things. And the important thing is to not get too fanatical about one theory and always treat our body to, like, we're scientists, right? So I'm trying this and trying that. Now I'm trying this way of training, which is very high volume of low intensity. And, you know, I'm keeping records, and in a few months, I'll see how I go.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we'll check up on you in a few months and see how you're doing then. Or you can give us the regular updates every episode.
This training regime coming along.
We'll keep you on track.
Thank you. I feel like you guys are my cheerleaders. I appreciate it.
All right.
It.
Very good. I guess we will check in on Angelica's progress next week or next time.
And that's all for this week's edition of the Grok Science Show. Make sure you tune in again next week for more from the world of science, technology, and the way they affect our daily lives. In the meantime, you can check us out on the web at www.groks.net, on Facebook and Twitter. You can also email us at science@groks.net or Grok Science on Frank Ling. Stay tuned here for more music.
So for Grok Science, I've been Charles Lee.
I'm Angelica from Taipei.
And I'm Frank from Tokyo.
Have a great afternoon and keep on grokking.